Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, August 20th, 2020, also known as National Radio Day. On the front page is a photograph of students outside Muhammad Seymour High School with the caption, "Schools in Session." Commitment, dedication. Some area schools have opened their doors. Gibson City, Melvin, Sibley on the right, there's a photograph there. Others, like Tuscola, are still in prep mode. The Warriors on Wednesday were happy to receive a helpful donation from the Ladies of the Mask Makers for Douglas County. Socially distant students chow down on day one of school Wednesday at Gibson City, Melvin, Sibley High School. And I must say, even though I see some of the students' masks in front of Muhammad Seymour, I don't see all of them, and there is not any social distancing going on. Illinois Impact, two elementary students test positive as classes resume in Muhammad. Arcola pushes back start of school. Two classrooms will be closed for 24 hours, and some classmates will be quarantined after two students at Muhammad's Middletown Prairie Elementary tested positive, district officials wrote Wednesday in a letter to families and staff. The news came on the first day of school in the district. Students who had prolonged close contact with their infected classmates will quarantine for 14 days, Superintendent Lindsay Hall and Nurse Nita Bachman wrote. Due to a variety of reasons, the start of in-person classes in Arcola has been bumped from today to Monday, Superintendent Tom Mulligan said. A district staffer tested positive over the weekend, Mulligan announced Sunday. Champaign County's seven-day positivity rate has never looked better, 0.3% or more than 14 times lower than the state's rate. Active cases were down by one Wednesday to 112, while hospitalizations remained at 9. For the first time, the state surpassed 50,000 tests results reported in a 24-hour period, with 50,299 yielding 2,295 cases, a one-day positivity rate of 4.6%. The state's seven-day rate was up slightly overnight from 4.3% to 4.4%. New emergency orders in effect in both cities will clamp down on mass scoff laws. Both Champaign and Urbana are welcoming University of Illinois students back with a spate of new emergency orders that officials hope will prevent a large-scale spike in COVID-19 cases. But these new rules aren't all limited to the U of I campus area. Some apply across both cities. A day after Champaign Mayor Deb Finan issued emergency orders with new restrictions for bars and restaurants, Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin issued an emergency order on Wednesday with some of the same restrictions, plus a requirement for the use of face masks in businesses and other public places with penalties for those who refuse. Finan subsequently issued two more emergency orders Wednesday, also requiring the use of face masks and prohibiting big parties at some properties. As of Wednesday, here is what has been ordered in both cities. Nobody under 21 is allowed in a bar after 9 p.m. All patrons at restaurants and bars must be seated, whether they indoors or outdoors, with standing allowed only for limited purposes such as going to the restroom, placing or picking up a carryout order, going to a gambling terminal, or entering or exiting. Masks must be worn in public places, indoors and out, when social distancing can't be maintained, and businesses that don't enforce that and individuals who won't wear one, both can be fined. In Champaign only, social gatherings are limited to a maximum of 10 people plus the host's family, and others legally permitted to live at the property. Plus, masks must be worn and social distancing observed. The party restrictions apply to campus area properties, including homes and apartments, all multifamily homes throughout Champaign, plus common areas, yards, and parking lots next to these properties. The prohibition also applies on all public property, unless the gatherings are otherwise permitted. Party hosts and guests violating this order can be cited with a city ordinance violation and fined up to $750. Also in Champaign only, campus town bars and restaurants are allowed to serve outdoors only, starting at 5 p.m. Wednesday for bars and 5 p.m. Friday for restaurants, and this temporary restriction will remain in effect through Labor Day. Both cities' emergency orders state that before any action is taken en masse, an enforcement officer would first order to let the violator put on a face covering that covers their nose and mouth, and failure to comply in a timely manner or subsequently removing the face covering to no longer cover the nose or mouth is deemed to be a violation of the order. Nearly everything in Urbana's new multi-restriction emergency order took effect immediately Wednesday morning, except for the prohibition on anyone under 21 being in a bar after 9 p.m., which is set to take effect on 9 p.m. Monday. "We know that the next few weeks are critical," Finan said Wednesday. "The city has had requests from businesses for help enforcing mask wearing," she said. "Under newly approved state regulations, businesses are held responsible for enforcing mask wearing and restrictions on gathering sizes and can be fined up to $2,500 for violations. But state regulations exempt individual violators who won't put on a mask or comply with social distancing from penalties." Finan said sometimes it's an 18-year-old retail employee at the door trying to hand out masks and enforce the requirement. "By adding requirements at the city level and the ability to enforce them," she said, "this makes it an individual responsibility. We wish these restrictions weren't necessary, but we're dealing with a public health crisis that hasn't changed much since it started," Marlin said. "With thousands of people returning to the community this fall, we have to be doubly careful," she said. "We need to practice social distancing measures, wear face coverings in public, and wash our hands frequently and avoid group gatherings, which can allow the virus to spread more quickly." Marlin also went on to say in a statement issued Wednesday morning, "It's not safe to hold parties in homes or yards. By taking these proactive steps now, we hope to avoid a spike in COVID-19 cases. Our goals remain the same. We strive to keep people healthy and avoid overwhelming our healthcare system. These actions are based on information the city has now," Marlin said. "We know that consistently wearing face coverings is one of the most effective ways that we, as individuals and as a community, can reduce the spread of COVID-19," she said. Marlin also said Wednesday that Urbana was still considering an order to prohibit large parties, and she pointed out it's not just students who can be guilty of gathering in large groups. "There are larger-than-permitted gatherings in backyards and other places," she said. "People have to understand that this is one of the most consistent ways to spread the disease," she said. Saliva test gets okay from FDA. The University of Illinois is now doing its new rapid saliva testing for the COVID-19 under the umbrella of an approved Food and Drug Administration emergency use authorization. A certified lab at the U of I performs a bridging study to a recently approved FDA emergency use authorization for Yale University's saliva test, showing the Illinois test, called iCOVID, performs at least as well as the recently approved saliva testing protocol, the university announced Wednesday. Yale announced this past weekend that its saliva test for COVID-19, called the Saliva Direct, had been granted the FDA emergency use authorization. Under emergency use authorizations, the FDA can allow for the use of unapproved medical products under certain criteria to diagnose, treat, or prevent life-threatening diseases needed during a public health emergency. This pioneering technology is a game changer that will help safeguard lives and livelihoods across the country, said U of I President Tim Killeen. It is one of many breakthroughs that the U of I system's world-class researchers have contributed to the battle against COVID-19, a battle that we are proud to help lead. Governor J.B. Pritzker applauded Killeen and the U of I research and development team. "Today's news puts the University of Illinois and the entire state of Illinois on the cutting edge of testing innovation on a national level," Pritzker said. "And let me just say to President Killeen, the state of Illinois looks forward to being your biggest customer." "If ongoing research continues to show positive results," Pritzker said, "this has potentially game-changing implications for our statewide testing program, as well as for testing on a national level." The U of I saliva test uses a small amount of saliva drooled into a sterile test tube that yields results in hours, even as at high testing volumes, the U of I said. The university has performed more than 50,000 of these saliva tests since making walk-up testing available to faculty, staff, and students in July. and expects to ramp up to 20,000 tests a day when the fall semester starts Monday. U of I chemistry professor Paul Hergenrother, who helped develop the test, says it has a key element that makes it uniquely suited for large-scale adoption. "We inactivate the virus without opening any tubes," he said. "The samples are immediately inactivated at 95 degrees centigrade for 30 minutes. That makes it very safe for the workers in the diagnostic lab." Fellow U of I saliva test designer Dr. Martin Burke, a physician and associate dean for research at the Carl Illinois College of Medicine, said direct saliva testing can address time, cost, and supply bottlenecks. "Our test has unique features that enable fast and frequent testing on a large scale, and we are now working together with many partners to make our testing method broadly available as soon as possible," he said. A life remembered, Matthew Correll. He was a fun-loving kid. If you needed a laugh or someone to lift your spirits, Matthew Correll was a good person to be around. That's how several people remember the 18-year-old Gifford resident. He was energetic, always making jokes, happy. He could make friends anywhere he went, said Danielle Birch, who got to know Mr. Correll as his swim coach and boss at Hap Parker Family Aquatic Center, where he was a lifeguard. "Marshall Horton called his late friend one of the funniest people I knew. He always just seemed so sure of himself, very happy, very fun to be around." Mr. Correll, who was on a bicycle, died from injuries he received Saturday night when he was hit by a car on U.S. 136 just east of Gifford. A 15-year-old Gifford resident was also struck and sustained non-life-threatening injuries. Andy Graham, Assistant Rantoul Recreation Department Director, remembered Mr. Correll as a good kid. "He was from a real good family. His parents, Brian M. and Kelly Four Correll, and his younger brother, Micah, are among his survivors." The Reverend Mark Wilkerson, pastor of the Correll's Family Church, Maranatha Baptist in Rantoul, said he knew the 2020 graduate of Rantoul Township High School from church and when he used to hang around with Wilkerson's son. "When he got into high school, they kind of went separate ways as far as interests and activities," Wilkerson said. "I always had a good interaction with him when he attended our church." Wilkerson is to officiate Mr. Correll's private funeral service. He said the night of the accident, Mr. Correll and the other bicyclists left their house about 8:30 p.m., drove south of Gifford, then east and back north. Instead of going across 136 like they usually did, they took a left, driving west toward Gifford, when they were struck by the vehicle. "It was pretty tragic," Wilkerson said. "He had loving parents. He professed faith as a young man." Wilkerson said Mr. Correll attended Calvary Baptist Christian Academy in Urbana. For his eighth grade year, he transferred to Gifford Grade School. "He was a fun-loving kid," Wilkerson said. "He had a good sense of humor, fun to be around." Linda T. Arks, Mr. Correll's eighth grade teacher, said despite transferring to the school for 1 year, he did a good deal of fitting in and making friends. "He was a very likable kid. The kids accepted him, and they got along together. His parents had done a good job of teaching him to respect authority," T. Arks said. Andrea Welty Peachy, Mr. Correll's choral and madrigal teacher at RTHS, said he had a knack for imitating voices and sounds. One day she handed out kazoos from the madrigals, and Mr. Correll produced the saxophone sound from the song Careless Whisper. "It just blew me away," Walter Peachy said. "He had a way of making voices and imitating people that was just so funny. He was very talented in that way." She said she didn't know Mr. Correll well because he was in chorus and madrigals for just 1 year, but noticed he had a way of cheering people up when they were down with his antics. "I've heard from a few kids since his passing. This is really hard for them," Walter Peachy said. Horton, who was a year younger than Mr. Correll, said he learned of his friend's death Saturday night when he received a text from another friend who asked if he had heard about the accident. It wasn't until later that he learned on Snapchat that Mr. Correll had died. Messages would say, "Rest in peace, Matthew," and I started to get worried. Birch said Mr. Correll was quite competitive and participated on the swim team for about 7 years. As a swimmer, This past year, he grew more, and he liked swim team a lot more, Birch said. He was a competitive driven. He was always trying to race others in his age group, even if they were on the same team. Even if none of the others from his age group showed up for practice, Mr. Correll did. He advanced to the conference swim meet in the 15 to 18 age group. As a lifeguard, she said Mr. Correll was dependable. He could always count on him, he said. He was always eager to help and do extra things, even when he wasn't told to. A drive-through visitation for Mr. Correll is scheduled from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at Rantoul's Lux Memorial Chapel. Following the private funeral service, burial will be in Hall Cemetery in Gifford. This is Top of the Morning from Jim Rosso. It's a bummer that CU's Got Talent, a helpful, lively fundraiser put on by Champaign West Rotary, won't take place in 2021. But co-founder and co-chairman Mike Hershey said Wednesday that we're not killing the event, adding that he's penciled in its return for February 2022 at Virginia Theater in Champaign. In its 5 years, CU's Got Talent has generated $182,000, with $166,000 already back in the community, Hershey said. Proceeds from February's show accounted for much of the chapter's $10,000 contribution to a Champaign County Rotary Response Fund that this week donated $37,000 to provide distance learning supplies for children in need. We'll have more in Saturday's News Gazette. Champaign Rotary chipped in $25,000, and individual Rotarians added another $2,000. Moved to the Virginia in 2019, CU's Got Talent lets locals take to the stage to sing, dance, and perform. We've been successful with it, Hershey said, but I don't see us terminating it. I see us, after 5 years, figuring out a way to do it bigger and better than before. And there's a picture of the principal at Gibson City Melvin Sibley High School, Principal Chris Girard, on Wednesday was dressed for the occasion, a socially distant and masked day at school. He has a t-shirt that reads Principal, and he has a big sign that he chalked in saying, "Welcome back." Mask makers showing plenty of school spirit. Tuscola. For a group that didn't form until the spring, the Mask Makers for Douglas County has wasted little time making a difference. The latest contribution from a collection of 40 hardworking women, batches of masks delivered to Tuscola High on Wednesday. Next week, the Mask Makers plan to take handmade supplies to schools in Arcola, Arthur, and Villa Grove. "We're just a group of volunteers, just ladies that can sew and crochet," said Tammy Bennett of Tuscola. In April, the Mask Makers made face coverings for nursing homes, first responders, and hospitals. In June, their attention turned towards schools. "Tuscola is blessed to have so many supportive people in this community," high school principal Steve Fiscus said. "The members of this group are willing to help out not only the local school districts, but first responders, nursing homes, and other county departments in any way they can. We are fortunate that the school district is still the center of the community where people come together for the good of all students. Working remotely and lately receiving help from the seniors of Tuscola's Jarman Center, the Mask Makers are organized in an efficient crew. They'll keep stitching as long as the coronavirus pandemic lingers. To volunteer, visit their Facebook page. I've been truly humbled by their commitment and dedication to help others," Bennett said. "They've worked countless hours and helped many people." We have a Jim Dye's column, "Prison Inmates Not Stripped of All Their Rights." A 2012 mass strip search of female prisoners at the Lincoln Correctional Center in Logan County was supposed to be a training exercise for aspiring correctional officers. It was that and much more, an adventure into constitutional law exploring how far the state can go when it conducts a strip search inside a prison. Prisoners possess few rights, but an en banc, all the judges, panel of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago recently found that prison officials can be held liable when they conduct unreasonable visual inspection of inmates' bodies. By an 11-to-1 vote, the en banc panel found a right to privacy in one's body and that inmates are entitled to an expectation of privacy that society would recognize as reasonable. "We hold that the Fourth Amendment projects in a severely limited way an inmate's right to bodily privacy during visual inspections, subject to unreasonable intrusions that the realities of incarceration often demand, wrote Justice Amy St. Eve for the court majority. Dissenting Justice Frank Easterbrook, taking a different perspective, said inmates are entitled to protection against abusive guards, but insisted the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment is the more appropriate vehicle to address possible guard misconduct. He defended the strip search tactic as a necessary evil because guards must be watchful in the cells, in the yards, in the cafeterias, in the showers, and even in the toilets, for violence may be planned or perpetuated in any of those places. The en banc panel sent the case back for further review by U.S. Judge Richard Mills of Springfield. At the same time, the Illinois Attorney General's office may ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision, opening the door to another potentially groundbreaking decision on the reach of the Fourth Amendment. That amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, is a constantly evolving area of the law. Much of this litigation is driven by its advances in technology, but locales like prisons can spark disputes. The lawsuit grew out of an event in which prison officers directed women to the gym while screaming obscenities at them and calling them sexually derogatory names, the appeals court stated. In the gym, correctional staff forced the women to stand facing the wall, shoulder to shoulder. Prison officials ordered training cadets to perform strip searches on groups of 4 to 10 women at a time. Prisoners were required to stand until cadets strip searched them, in some cases waiting 5 to 7 hours. The women could not sit, get a drink of water, or use the restroom for the duration of the training exercise, St. Eve wrote, noting that female cadets conducted the searches. In the original lawsuit, lawyers for the women claimed that guards violated both the Fourth and Eighth Amendments to the Constitution. Mills dismissed the Fourth Amendment claim. A jury rejected the women's Eighth Amendment claim, apparently finding no abuse, the standard outlined by Easterbrook in his dissent. Last year, the Seventh Circuit Court affirmed Mills' dismissal, with Easterbrook writing the court's 2-1 decision. After that ruling, the full circuit decided to conduct an en banc interview in which all 12 justices participated. The en banc's 11-person majority includes both liberal justices, Diane Wood and Alana Rovner, and conservatives, Dan Mannion and Amy Coney Barrett. In reaching their decision, the justices balanced the competing interests of prison security and inmate privacy. The justices found that inmates have no privacy rights when it comes to the property they own and the space they occupy because of the need for close and continual observation by guards. But they ruled that it's a different matter with respect to inmates' bodies. While prison security requires officials to constantly monitor prisoners' cells, the same is not true of their unclothed persons, St. Eve wrote. We have another photograph with some cars driving up, and the title is Gearing Up for Remote Learning. Champaign School District Nurse Cindy Limentato hands out Chromebooks to families Wednesday outside Westview Elementary School in Champaign. The devices, which will be handed out all week at all Champaign schools, are being given to students who did not get one in the spring so they can begin remote learning. Statues of two slave-owning men with historical ties to Illinois will be moved from the State House grounds in Springfield to a secure storage site, a panel of four officials voted Wednesday morning. The decision comes almost 6 weeks after House Speaker Michael Madigan asked the Office of the Architect to move expeditiously in evicting representatives of Stephen A. Douglas and Pierre Menard from the Capitol. Madigan's request was the longtime Chicago Democrats' first public statement in the wake of civil unrest sparked by the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died May 25th after a white Minneapolis police officer held his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes. Douglas was a slave owner who served as Illinois Secretary of State and in the U.S. Senate. He proposed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which repealed the Missouri Compromise and replaced it with a system for states to decide whether to be pro- or anti-slavery. Menard, also a slave owner, who was the first lieutenant governor of Illinois, and he supported political actions devised to ensure slavery was legal in the state. Memorializing people in a time that allowed slavery and fostered bigotry and oppression has no place in the Illinois House, where the work of all Illinoisans is conducted, Madigan wrote in the July 9th statement. We can only move forward in the creating a more just world where these symbols of hate are removed from our everyday lives. Capitol architect Andrea Eggert said her office had already contacted firms to remove the two statues. The work order, which also includes removing the figure's bases and foundations, can be completed in 2 to 3 months. She added that the granite bases could be repurposed. Board members of the Office of the Architect of the Capitol also began the process to move a bronze 300-pound likeness of Martin Luther King Jr. to an appropriate location at the building. The statue is currently at the intersection of 2nd Street and Capitol Avenue, colloquially referred to as Freedom Corner, in front of the Illinois State Library. Scott Kaiser, Assistant Secretary of the Senate and a member of the board, said at some point in the future the group should consider commissioning a new portrayal of King, a leader of the civil rights movement in the 1950s. No offense to whoever did it, but I just think that's a poor rendering of Dr. King, and I think we can do better, he said. The likeness is located across the street from the State House because of an administrative rule dictating that only historical figures related to Illinois are permitted to be installed on the Capitol grounds. The panel approved a motion to revise those guidelines. John Holman, clerk of the House and co-chair of the board, proposed each of the items acted upon on Wednesday. He did not suggest specific language for the rule change, only the end goal of ensuring the King statue is moved. Brad Bolin, assistant clerk of the House, pointed out the board will need to reconvene to formalize and approve the alteration. It would then go to the Joint Commission on Administration Rules for the final action before it could take effect. There was a discussion about why the focus of Holman's proposals pertained to the controversial statues outside the State House, but not the ones inside. Another statue of Douglas, for example, is on the second level of the Capitol in the rotunda. The outdoor statue is certainly prominent, but as people come into the building, school groups do tours. In some ways, the indoor statue is even more prominent than the outdoor one, Kaiser said. I just see inconsistency. There is a little bit. It just needs to meet. Seems to me that we're making a decision now on Douglas. There's two of them. Why not take them both out? Bolin also inquired why there was no system in place to receive public comment about the artwork removal. Lawmakers could utilize committees already instituted to generate public discussion, he suggested. Holman also proposed contacting a firm to update members on historical structures, so we kind of know what we have on our hands currently on the complex and maybe how we want to treat those going forward. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, August 20th, 2020. Please stay tuned for Part 2.